From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the life of Edward R. Murrow. We'll talk about the influential journalist with radio host Bob Edwards, who wrote a biography of Murrow. The new feature film, Good Night and Good Luck, chronicles Murrow's on-air conflict with Senator Joe McCarthy. Also, Wallace and Gromit in The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. We'll hear from animator Nick Park. The triple Oscar winner tells us how he brings his stop animation characters to life. And our film critic David Edelstein has a review of Park's new full-length feature. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember the most important and influential newsman in broadcast history, Edward R. Murrow. As a CBS radio war correspondent based in England, he broadcast from the rooftops as the Nazis bombed the city. He began each report with the words, "This is London," one of two signature phrases for which Murrow still is remembered. The other is from later in his career, when he moved to the young medium of television to host a bold documentary program called See It Now. Murrow ended each See It Now telecast by telling viewers, "Good night and good luck," which is where George Clooney got the title for his new movie about Murrow. His film, Good Night and Good Luck, starring David Strathairn as Murrow, opens in many cities today. The film concentrates on the period of Murrow's career leading to his controversial and critical showdown with communist witch-hunting Senator Joe McCarthy. On today's Fresh Air, we salute one exceptional broadcaster, Edward R. Murrow, by listening to another. Bob Edwards, who spent just shy of 25 years as host of National Public Radio's Morning Edition, wrote a wonderful book about Murrow titled Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. Edwards is now the host of The Bob Edwards Show on XM Satellite Radio. He spoke with Terry last year and began their conversation by reading from his biography of Murrow.
Murrow's obituaries mentioned that he seemed a courtly prince who nevertheless championed the underdog, a sophisticated man with a common touch. Variety said he had brought television to maturity. He was hailed for his unrelenting search for truth. The tributes pointed out that he had led CBS to greatness, only to become expendable when his principles clashed with management. It fell to Murrow's biographers, however, to explore some of the deeper contradictions in his life, including the black moods and day-long silences that frequently haunted a man who had so many reasons to be happy. The man who oozed confidence on the air was a nervous wreck when about to begin a broadcast. The shot of whiskey he'd have to calm his nerves at airtime failed to stop his cold sweat or keep him from jiggling his leg in a continuous nervous tic. America's foremost broadcast journalist put so much weight on his own shoulders that he could never be at peace. He was a driven man who demanded more of himself than he could possibly deliver. Murrow lived by a code too rigid for mere humans to meet. He expected more of himself and others. Murrow's glass was always half empty. He felt the gloom of having his idealism shattered by reality.
It's Bob Edwards reading from his new book, Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. Bob, welcome back to Fresh Air. You were asked to write a book for this series of biographies. Were you aware of him in his own time as a broadcaster, or was it only after that that you started to be aware of him and admire him so much?
Oh, no. I listened to him on the radio and saw him on television. I was a kid, and maybe I didn't understand all of the nuances of his insights and to the Eisenhower administration. But here on one level, it was very easy to relate to him being a kid. He was cool. He was so cool. He looked great. He sounded fabulous. And I wanted to do that because of him. Now, later, of course, I appreciated what he did and his McCarthy broadcast. And, of course, all of his wartime reporting was before my time because I'm post-war. And to get into those into the transcripts of his broadcasts and see how he wrote and the imagery, which I'm no good at all. I mean, he wrote beautiful word pictures, and the sound of them. He was a speech major in college, and I think that helped a lot. When he spoke, it was theater. It was, I just wanted to do that. You know?
You say in your book that most of the material is drawn from 30 years of conversations with Ed Bliss, who, among other things, was your teacher in graduate school at American University, someone you kept in touch with for years. What was his connection with Murrow?
He wrote for Murrow. He joined CBS during the war when Murrow was over in Europe. Ed Bliss was in New York. And then when Murrow came back and did a nightly radio program, Bliss was his radio writer. And traveled with him when they would go on the road. Ed Murrow would have to make speeches or whatever, and Ed Bliss would go with him to write his newscast for the evening and edit the commentary that, Ed Murrow would write. And Ed Bliss taught Ed Murrow. That was his presentation in college. And the real shame is that Ed Bliss died last year at age 90, just as I was being contacted about writing this book. And we didn't have this experience to share. This would have been so great, and he would have been so helpful to me, and I would just, you know, I wish he were around to enjoy this occasion.
What are some of the things he told you about Murrow that you might not have gotten from the biographies of Murrow? And I'm wondering particularly if he offered you insights into Murrow's depressions and,
yes,
and black moods.
He did indeed. They would be riding around the car, and Ed would be driving and maybe getting them lost. And this would be the only time that Murrow would get upset with him. And you knew Murrow was upset when he called you Buster. I've never read this anywhere. That, look, Buster. And then you knew you were in trouble. And yes, he would have these long silences that I guess he would just be off in a world of thought all to himself. And you and I might consider that rude, that we're in the company of this fellow and he's just not talking to us. But, you know, those close to Murrow had to get used to that. And on other occasions, he could be the life of the party and buy you drinks and tell you great stories and sing songs from the lumber camps of the Pacific Northwest where he grew up. And he had these mood swings.
Now, Ed Murrow didn't set out to be a broadcaster. He was sent to Europe to arrange broadcasts by others for the Institute of International Education, which was part of the Carnegie Endowment. And even in his early days with CBS, he was supposed to arrange for newspaper reporters to actually do the reporting. What was the state of radio news at the time Murrow entered radio broadcasting?
Announcers would do everything. They would host a program with a dance band, and then the Henley Regatta, and then they would interview a starlet, and then they would cover a news conference. They did everything. It was amazing, these people, people like Graham McNamee at NBC, who was Red Barber's hero, by the way, and Robert Trout at CBS. These guys were amazing, the variety of things they had to do. But they were not professional journalists. And that's what Ed Murrow started, because the war broke out, and he needed a professional news staff to tell New York and all of America what was going on in Europe. So the first person he hired was William L. Shirer, who was a veteran foreign correspondent. And thereafter, he hired just the most amazing staff as the war spread. People who had come from wire services, mostly United Press. He just robbed United Press blind of all their great talent. And some others were newspaper reporters. But we're talking about Eric Severide and Howard K. Smith, Bill Downs, Charles Collingwood, Winston Burdett. Fabulous, fabulous people who remained in broadcast journalism for decades after.
Was it Murrow's idea to put himself on the air?
No, I think it just kind of happened. And New York didn't complain, and it was so successful that first broadcast in the spring of, was it March of 1938, when the Nazis marched into Austria and annexed Austria. That's the real beginning of the war. And they had to just go on the air and do a broadcast. And Shirer wasn't supposed to be on the air either. He was you know, Murrow's man on the continent of Europe, and he was to arrange broadcasts. But out of this emergency, they became the genesis of the CBS overseas reporting staff, and they were so good at it that they just kept on reporting the war and adding these other newspaper reporters to the staff.
One of Murrow's now famous broadcast was part of a special program called London After Dark that CBS Radio broadcast on August 24th, 1940. He was reporting from Trafalgar Square. What's the importance, do you think, of this particular broadcast?
A couple of things. When Hitler started bombing England, he first chose military targets, bases and the docks and that sort of thing. And then he upgraded it and just scatterbombed all over all the cities of England to terrify the population in hopes that they would ask Churchill to surrender and just stop this awful bombing. And Murrow was trying to illustrate that it wasn't working. And he's he's at Trafalgar Square, and he's recording people calmly walking to the bomb shelters, not running, not in a panic. He wanted that message out there. So he put the microphone down on the ground and recorded footsteps. He was very conscious of the, for a guy with no background in either journalism or radio, he was conscious of the fact that he was writing for the ear, and this broadcast was to reach you by ear, sound. So he would let you hear the footsteps of Englanders walking calmly to the bomb shelter. I thought that was very prescient of him. He knew he was in radio. This was something different. This was not the printed page. It was for the ear.
Well, why don't we hear some of that report by Edward R. Murrow, August 24th, 1940, from Trafalgar Square.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. One single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue. Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are, just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the portholes. More searchlights come into action. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes.
That was Edward R. Murrow, recorded in 1940. My guest is Bob Edwards, who's written a new biography of Edward R. Murrow. Bob, you mentioned in your book that at the time, like during World War II, the networks had actually banned recording. So even if Edward R. Murrow had the technology to record sounds and then produce it within his report, he wouldn't have been able to do it. Why was this ban on? Why did the networks ban recording?
Well, like everything else with networks, it had to do with money. The networks felt that if they played recordings of, say, Paul Whiteman's orchestra or Bing Crosby singing, then you wouldn't need a network. You could go out and buy that recording yourself, or your local station could provide that for you. The reason you needed a network was to bring you Paul Whiteman and Bing Crosby, the actual, in real time, live broadcast of the great, entertainers of the time. So they just extended that to news. I mean, for one thing, they weren't really in the news business until the war. So everything that you heard of Murrow and his team up until D-Day was live. And they would be in the middle of a war zone somewhere. And this is the most amazing thing, the technical aspect of their reporting, because it was shortwave. You had to be near a shortwave transmitter and just hope New York would hear you and stop regular broadcast and break in and say, here's a report from Charles Collingwood in Northern Africa. And then Charles would be on. And it was hit or miss. A lot of these reporters were just talking into the air and were never heard. Their reports were never heard because, New York didn't get the signal that that one of their reporters was trying to reach them with a live broadcast. So if Murrow had an interview he wanted to do, he had to take his guest to the microphone and talk to him live. He wouldn't go record it. They finally changed their mind on D-Day because Collingwood and some others had made recordings landing on the beaches and all that, and they thought that was so compelling that people needed to hear that, and they couldn't hear it live, so they replayed the tape. I think, in fact, Richard C. Hodlett was the only one whose report was actually heard on D-Day. He was with the paratroopers and got back to London on the day, on June 6, 1944, and broadcast. The others were just caught up in the war in France and had no means of being heard that day or for several days thereafter.
Bob Edwards speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with former NPR Morning Edition host Bob Edwards, author of a biography of Edward R. Murrow. A new film about Murrow, Good Night and Good Luck, is now in theaters.
You say that Murrow reported on the bomb shelters, but he didn't usually go to the bomb shelters himself. Why not?
He was afraid that he would get used to it. That whenever the bombs fell, he would go running for the shelter if he went that first time. So he would go and do stories of people in the shelters, but he would not go there to seek refuge from the bombs himself. He had enormous courage, not just from bombs, but from other things that came along later, like McCarthy, or even his own bosses. But he would be up on the rooftop in the middle of the bombing of London, so he could report on it. And he would go around town in an open car so he could see the damage and report on the stories at ground level.
Yeah, the reporting from the rooftop, that really amazes me. You know, German bombers are flying overhead, and he's on a rooftop in London reporting on what he sees. That really takes courage. It must have been difficult to get permission to do that, because he needed the permission of the British to do it. What was it like for him to get permission, and what kind of guidelines did they lay down for him?
Well, at first they didn't want him to do it at all, because they thought that the Germans could hone in on him or use him as some kind of beacon or locator to direct bombing. He was on the rooftop of Broadcasting House, a BBC building in London, and they thought that he would make that building a target. Well, later on, I mean, it got hit a bunch of times. And a lot of Murrow's colleagues at the BBC were killed as a result. But on this particular night that he first went up there, you know, he had mixed emotions about it. He was kind of ambivalent because, you know, it was, again, a live broadcast, and New York threw the signal to Murrow on that rooftop at, you know, probably 7 o'clock in the evening or something like that, New York time, 5 hours later in London. And all hell had been going on until a minute to air, and then the bombing stopped. And he's thinking, you know, is this good or bad? Because they can't hear the bombs. They could hear the anti-aircraft fire, and you hear a lot of that, so you do get some war sounds, and you hear the police whistles or the air raid warden whistles, and you hear sirens and the like, but you don't hear actual bombs. But he wanted the bang bang, of course, because it was radio. And the British government relented on permission to have Murrow on the rooftop. And I think it was Churchill's doing personally, because Churchill wanted America to know what was going on and what Britons were taking from Hitler's Germany. This was good PR, propaganda, if you will, for England. And America, you know, he was really appealing for help and using Murrow to do that.
Let's hear an excerpt of the rooftop report that you were referring to, the one in which the bombing is temporarily stopped, but you can hear the anti-aircraft artillery. So this is Edward R. Murrow, recorded in mid-September of 1940.
The plane is still very high, and it's quite clear that he's not coming in for his bombing run. Earlier this evening, we could hear occasionally, again, those were explosions overhead. Earlier this evening, we heard a number of bombs go sliding and slithering across to fall several blocks away. just overhead now the burst of the anti-aircraft fire. Still, the nearby guns are not working, and the searchlights now are feeling almost directly overhead. Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are. That hard, stony sound.
So that was Edward R. Murrow, recorded from a rooftop of the BBC in 1940. My guest is Bob Edwards, and he's written a new biography of Edward R. Murrow. Bob, what was the impact of these broadcasts on Americans? And this is, you know, before America entered the war.
That's right, and they were enormously helpful to Churchill in England. And at one point, Roosevelt sent Harry Hopkins, his close aide, over to London. And he arranged a meeting with Murrow, and Murrow thought, well, this is great. I'm going to get an interview with Harry Hopkins. This will be very useful. No, that wasn't it. Hopkins wanted to interview Murrow. Murrow was the first guy he talked to when he went to London before he talked to anyone in the British government. Why? Because he wanted to pick Murrow's brain. He wanted to know what was going on in England, who to see, who not to see, who was... You know, who was really in charge, who were the movers and shakers and players, and who had the best information on what was going on. That's a tribute to Murrow's influence, command of information. But those broadcasts, I mean, that's what Roosevelt was hearing. He was hearing Murrow's broadcasts from the rooftop and everywhere else in London.
Bob Edwards speaking with Terry Gross last year. More in the second half. I'm David Biancooley. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from NPR member stations and Barnes & Noble, featuring Bob and Melinda Blanchard's Live What You Love, Notes from an Unusual Life, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of A Briefer History of Time, an updated and revised edition by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow, available in hardcover, and from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the epic adventure Kingdom of Heaven from the director of Gladiator and starring Orlando Bloom on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Wallace and Gromit are back in theaters after 6 years. We'll meet animator Nick Park. The three-time Oscar winner has scored another hit with Wallace and Gromit in The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. Also, David Edelstein reviews the film. And we'll continue our conversation with Bob Edwards about the life of Edward R. Murrow. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with former NPR Morning Edition host Bob Edwards, who now has his own show on the XM satellite network. Edwards is the author of Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism, a biography of the CBS newsman whose story also serves as the inspiration for George Clooney's new movie, Good Night and Good Luck.
I want to play an excerpt of one more Murrow report. This is another really famous one, and it's his report from Buchenwald, the death camp right after it was liberated. And this is a pretty incredible piece of reporting. Bob, do you want to say something about it before we hear it?
Yeah. The war was winding down, and Murrow wanted one last little bit of action, so he joined up with Patton's army, and Charles Collingwood was along too. So Collingwood tells this story, that they had a night of poker. And Murrow is one of those knights. You know, Murrow just could not lose. And he's raking in all the dough from all the war correspondents, and he's stuffing bills into every pocket of his war correspondent's uniform. Next day, they go to Buchenwald. And Murrow was just devastated. And he just started emptying his pockets and handing all this cash to survivors, and I don't know, at that point, could you even call them survivors? Probably a lot of the people he talked to that day didn't survive more than a couple more days.
He called them the living dead.
Yeah. And he was angry. He was just angry. And he didn't broadcast that day. He let others have the scoop. And by the way, the whole liberation of Buchenwald was upstage because Roosevelt died that day. I mean, it was probably inside every paper and not on the front pages. Murrow went back to London, and it was 3 days later before he did this broadcast, which is now the most famous about the liberation of Buchenwald.
Well, why don't we hear an excerpt of that report from Buchenwald, and this is Edward R. Murrow.
In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only six. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. D-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die. An elderly man standing beside me said, the children, enemies of the state. I could see their ribs through their thin shirts. The children clung to my hands and stared. We crossed to the courtyard. Men kept coming up to speak to me and to touch me. Professors from Poland, doctors from Vienna, men from all Europe. Men from the countries that made America. We proceeded to the small courtyard. There were two rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little. I tried to count them as best I could and arrived at the conclusion that all that was mortal of more than 500 men and boys lay there in two neat piles. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation, but the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald. God alone knows how many men and boys have died there during the last 12 years. I pray you to believe what I have said about Buchenwald. I have reported what I saw and heard, but only part of it. For most of it, I have no words. If I have offended you by this rather mild account of Buchenwald, I am not in the least sorry.
That was Edward R. Murrow. My guest is Bob Edwards, who's written a new biography of Murrow. It's called Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. After World War II, Murrow becomes vice president and director of public affairs at CBS. He assembles a news team. Most of them go on to become some of the most famous people in broadcasting journalism. He moves from radio to television, helps define what television news is. And then, of course, he's covering things during the McCarthy era. And one of the things he's asked to do at CBS is to sign a loyalty oath. And I think a lot of his colleagues were expecting him to refuse, but he didn't refuse. Why didn't he refuse?
I think he picked his battles, and he thought that one was too big. And he could fight McCarthyism and the whole anti-communist hysteria in other ways, which he certainly did with his broadcast on See It Now, which was really the end, the beginning of the end of Joe McCarthy and his demagoguery.
What did Murrow do on that broadcast that helped turn the tide against McCarthy?
Murrow's thing about McCarthy had to do with the Constitution, had to do with due process. I think everyone understood there probably were communists in the government, and this was not a good thing. But whether there were or there weren't, the accused should be given due process. So what Murrow did was to assemble a whole bunch of film of McCarthy illustrating his methods. And that was a revelation to most Americans who only knew about this from newspapers. And newspapers can't give you a good account of this. You know, Senator McCarthy said this, but somebody else said that. And, you know, you really don't get a flavor of what this guy was about and how he badgered people and just the unfairness of the whole prosecutorial process that he conducted, and how you were really guilty until proven innocent, and you had no shot at proving your innocence. So that's what Murrow did, exposed him in that way, and then showed you a huge stack of newspapers and representing editorials against McCarthy, and another stack of newspapers, you know, that favored him, a much, much, much smaller stack. And then did his closing commentary, which was unlike anything television ever did before, and certainly since. It was a one-of-a-kind, it was a blatant editorial, and just devastating. And
what did he say that was so devastating?
No one familiar with the history of this country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigation and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. His primary achievement has been in confusing the public mind between the internal and external threat of communism. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes which were, for the moment, unpopular. You know, Ed Bliss told me he was in New York once, and he saw someone coming at him that he thought this was not good. This person was going to do him harm. And he thought of crossing the street and mingling with a bigger crowd of people and getting away from this guy. And he remembered Murrow's words, "We will not walk in fear one of another." So he didn't cross the street, and he got mugged.
Oh, gee, what's the moral of that story?
The moral of that story. The moral of the story is... be a little more practical, right. A little less hero worshiping.
Well, that's great. What did CBS have to say about this? As you pointed out, this is editorializing.
Yeah. For one thing, they didn't promote the program. Murrow and his co-producer and partner, Fred W. Friendly, bought. They used their personal money to buy a full-page ad in the New York Times to promote the program. CBS was not... pleased. Of course, they said, you know, this was great and thank you so much, but they didn't promote the program. And they didn't like controversy. Bill Paley, the founding chairman of CBS, and Murrow were very close. They had a relationship that was not boss-worker, forged during the war. But after the war, it was different. CBS became this big diversified company. Profits and the price of a share of stock were what was important, and they were in the entertainment business, and here was Murrow doing all these controversial programs. Paley told Murrow, your programs give me stomach aches. And Murrow told Paley, well, it goes with the job. And ultimately, see it now, Murrow's great news vehicle was canceled. And Murrow was moved to the margins of CBS because he was just too controversial.
Bob Edwards, speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. He now hosts The Bob Edwards Show on XM Satellite Radio. He's also the author of Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism. Up next, Wallace and Gromit animator Nick Park. This is Fresh Air. The cheese-loving inventor Wallace and his faithful dog Gromit have returned in the new animated film The Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
I'm in the mood for food! Grommet, old pal, I'll need assistance.
Animator Nick Park created the much-loved Wallace and Gromit characters, the ones familiar from such animated comedy shorts as The Wrong Trousers and A Close Shave, both of which won Academy Awards. Park recently learned that his first full-length movie starring Wallace and Gromit, the new Curse of the Were-Rabbit, had sold enough tickets in America to be crowned the box office champ on its first week of release. That was the good news. The bad news was that a warehouse fire at Aardman Studios, where all of Park's stop animation films are produced, had consumed all the props and sets from his previous films. Well, almost all. The original plasticine figures of Wallace and Gromit were with Park at the time of the fire and are safe. Aardman Studios was founded in 1972. Nick Park was hired in 1986, straight out of film school, and has been there ever since, creating Wallace, Gromit, and lots of other charmingly eccentric and lovable animated characters. Park's previous full-length film, Chicken Run, was directed by Peter Lord, chairman of Aardman Studios, who has worked with Park for 20 years. Terry spoke with Nick Park and Peter Lord in 2000 when Chicken Run was released. Her first question went to Peter Lord.
It's so funny that you're doing this very sophisticated kind of animation with this kind of comparatively unsophisticated style of animation, really literally moving around clay puppets. At the same time, that the big animation is the computer animation that everybody seems to be using now. Do you feel like you're living in another world than the computer animated people? Do you feel like you're in just another dimension altogether?
People often ask us about this, understandably, because computer animation is very visible. And I mean, our attitude is always very simply, well, why can't the two coexist? You know, why on earth should the new technology push out the old if the old works? You know, why should a synthesized instrument replace an acoustic instrument? Why should it? No, it obviously, evidently shouldn't. The two, in a sensible, sane world, the two will coexist. So I hope that will always be the case. Having said that, it is kind of ridiculous. I mean, our technology is quite so old-fashioned, you know. But heaven knows it worked. And also, you know, because it's hands-on, which it is, because it is, it consists of animators in studios handling clay models, and because also, strangely enough, strangely to your listeners, it's like a live performance. And that may sound crazy because everyone always talked about, you know, the words agonizing and painstaking are always on our lips. It is a slow process, but it's a live process because you've got your puppet, and your puppet is going to walk across the set from point A to point B. When that puppet sets off in the morning, you have no real way of knowing where it's going to go to. You know, you guess, of course, you approximate, you rehearse, but you don't know exactly. And when you're halfway across the set, you still don't know precisely where you're going, and you don't know, and you certainly can't go back, just as in real life. You know, you're a performer on the stage. You start the performance, you don't know exactly where you're going, and you sure as hell can't change what you've already done. And in that sense, what we do is live, whereas computer animation and conventional cell animation isn't like that, because you can do the last drawing at the same time as the first drawing and then fill in the spaces in between. Or, if it's not going well, you can easily revise it. We can't easily revise what we do. The only thing we can do is shoot it again.
Yeah. Now, Nick Park, most of your animations have bizarre contraptions of one sort or another in them. In fact, before I ask you the actual question, why don't you describe a couple of contraptions from your Wallace and Gromit movies?
Right. What from? You mean A Close Shave?
Sure.
There's the Wrong Trousers, which are ex-NASA, in fact, that are actually bought from an ex-NASA store in Wallace's neighborhood, and Wallace uses them to. They're covered in rivets. They're very round and robust, and have a sort of 1940s feel, and I guess same too with the Knitomatic machine in A Close Shave. That's all covered in copper sheeting and rivets and that kind of thing, and lots of arms and lots of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, and Victorian technology. I like to describe it as.
Yeah, and like the knit-o-matic, you put a whole sheep in one end of the machine, and out comes yarn, and by the end of the machine, I think a little sweater is coming out. These bizarre contraptions. Now, your father was an inventor. Did he make contraptions?
Well, he wasn't. I don't think I would describe him as an inventor, but he did make a lot of things. He spent his time in the shed making things.
What kinds of things?
Well, a lot of household things, you know, just shelves, that kind of thing.
Made that caravan. Did he make a caravan?
Oh, that's right, yes. That's what made, after making the first Wallace and Gromit film, A Grand Day Out, I realised one day, he's so much like Wallace, because I recall this childhood experience where my father built a trailer, you know, from scratch. It was like just a room on wheels, like a living room on wheels, and with beds inside, and made everything, and wallpapered it with furniture, and it had furniture and chairs and all that kind of thing. And the whole family, seven of us, went on holiday in this caravan.
Were you taken to any unusual factories when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Boy, I had this terrible experience of going to a chicken slaughterhouse. When I was a kid. I was actually a student at the time. I was doing a summer job, and I was working at a chicken packing factory, folding up plucked chickens and putting them onto trays and feeding them into this great big machine that wrapped them for the supermarket. And actually, one day I was sent down to the slaughterhouse, because they were short of labour there, and saw some pretty horrific things there. And some of those ideas from both those experiences have actually come through and been used in Chicken Run.
Your characters of Wallace and Gromit, which are so popular now, tell us if you kind of pattern them on anyone you knew, either in real life or in the movies. And I should say Wallace is a British man who's very stuffy and proper sounding, but in reality he's really not very bright. Gromit is his dog, and the dog is the smart one who reads books like The Republic by Pluto. So who's behind these characters?
Boy, I don't think I ever really consciously based them on anybody particularly. Wallace, perhaps, you know, when I think about it, you know, for reasons that I've given, he is very close to my dad, who, was very, he was like an inventor and made things. But I think it's his attitude, actually, the way he'll just get ideas and go about doing them without thinking. And he'll be, my dad isn't insensitive, but Wallace is very insensitive another influence, actually, he's very much like an old music hall character that's very much known in Britain, in the north, comes from the north of England, who plays a banjo, ukulele, and called George Formby. And he was very popular, I think, before the war and before the Second World War. And he's got a very similar accent and very similar attitude to Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it wasn't very conscious. You know, to base him, he isn't based on him, but I think these influences have found themselves in Wallace.
At the end of Wallace and Gromit films, at least at the end of a couple of them, Wallace always yearns for some cheese. Mm-hmm. So why don't we end our interview with finding out about cheese? Why why does Wallace want cheese?
Well, how do ideas come about? I think the single reason there's cheese, because it all starts when Wallace and Gromit go to the moon to find cheese, and I was trying to think of a reason why they would go to the moon. And then, you know, we record the voices first, and I recorded with Peter Salis, the actor who plays Wallace. It's just the way he said, "Cheese, Gromit!" And that made such a nice mouth shape for Wallace. It was such a nice thing to have him get his chops around, that cheese stuck, and it appeared in all the other movies. In fact, there's a very short little story that there's a factory in the north of England that makes a type of cheese called Wensleydale cheese, and we made Wallace say Wensleydale one in the third film in a close shave, and just by doing that, it actually put the cheese factory was on its last legs and about to go into liquidation. And it put the cheese factory back in business.
Are you kidding?
And,
That's funny.
The Wensleydale Cheese Factory.
Well, I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
Nick Park speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. His new animated film is Wallace and Gromit and the Curse of the Were-Rabbit. This is Fresh Air. Wallace and Gromit and the Curse of the Were-Rabbit was the number one movie at the box office last week, and a triumph for its directors, Nick Park and Steve Box. But that good cheer was dampened by that warehouse fire. Critic David Edelstein mourns the loss, but celebrates the success of Wallace and Gromit and the Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
The news that the animator Nick Park had lost a warehouse of models to fire is especially upsetting, because these models, the chickens of Chicken Run, some Wallace and Gromit figures, they're more than mere cartoon characters. They're puppets brought to soulful life by claymation, frame by loving frame, in the old manner of pose the figure and shoot and move it a wee wee bit and shoot, and you can sometimes see the finger marks and feel the life force of their caretakers. There's something else that's old-fashioned about dear, enterprising Wallace and his much smarter, silent dog Gromit, who live together like an old married couple. They strike me as the summit, the apotheosis of those New Yorker magazine squibs that used to appear under the rubric, "There'll Always Be an England." These excerpts from British papers were hilarious reminders of the blinkered aristocracy of P.G. Woodhouse, but they also evoked the ordinary middle-class folks living in a sort of hermetically sealed bubble of genteel repression. The England of Wallace and Gromit is the England of row house backyard gardens under low gray skies and obliviously proper gardeners busy cultivating vegetables for county competitions. It's an England stuck in the 50s that never much concerned itself with the sunset of an empire. For this England, the more urgent problem is rabbits. Which brings us to Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit, an absolutely magical fusion of horror and deadpan English comedy, the kind the Ealing Studios made in the 50s. The pair now run a pest control outfit called Anti-Pesto that humanely dispatches the beasts who threaten potentially prize-winning carrots, pumpkins, and so on. The way that Wallace is whisked out of bed would make Rube Goldberg gasp with delight. And even more enchanting is the rabbit vacuum cleaner that deposits the creatures in a glass jar where they spin around with apparent glee. Thanks to his non-lethal ways, Wallace has even managed to endear himself to an aristocratic sock puppet beauty with red hair sticking out at right angles from her head like a pair of sausages. Alas, Wallace isn't content with giving hundreds of rabbits a home in his basement. He wants to reform them. He wants to brainwash them in a fantastical brainwashing machine into swearing off vegetables altogether.
The solution to all our storage problems. Simply by connecting the bun vac to the mind manipulation-o-matic, we can brainwash the bunnies. Rabbit rehabilitation. Once cured of their antisocial veg-ravaging behavior, the rabbits can be safely released without fear of reoffending. Just a little added lunar power to enhance the mind waves. And we can begin. Veg bad. Veg bad. Veg bad. Say no to carrots, cabbage, and cauliflower.
That's the splendid 84-year-old Peter Salas as Wallace, and the music of Julian Nott and three other composers is a wonderful pastiche. I hear echoes of the British light music genre, especially popular in the 50s, with the witty addition of Spielbergian choirs. Later, there are thunderous passages that would not be out of place in a Hammer horror film. For Wallace's Frankensteinian endeavors end up producing the most fearsome rabbit since Monty Python and the Holy Grail, requiring Gromit to bail him out of a more cataclysmic mess than ever before. This is the best ever blend of horror and comedy, leaving contenders like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein in the dust. Oh, the puns are cheesy, but only in the sense that cheese-loving Wallace reads East of Edom and Waiting for Gouda. The claymation is the best of both worlds, the hand-fashioned and the computerized. Peter Jackson will be lucky to have anything as thrilling in his upcoming King Kong as the revelation of the giant were-rabbit in pieces as Gromit gives chase in an automobile while the beast devours one garden after another. Even then, Jackson won't have Gromit with that deadpan young old face that sees all but interferes when only absolutely necessary, because he must love the notion, too, that there'll always be an England. The one lucky break about that warehouse fire? None of the newer Wallace and Gromit models or anything from Curse of the Were-Rabbit was there. Hail Britannia! Wallace and Gromit live.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org, and from the Ford Foundation, announcing winners of the Leadership for a Changing World Awards, honoring people, inspiring change, online at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, on beauty, we talk with best-selling author Zadie Smith. Her new book is set in a fictional New England college town and follows the lives of two mixed-race families. Smith also is the author of the novel White Teeth. Join us for the next Fresh Air.